Welcome to New World Notes. I'm Kenneth Doust. The flip side of imperialism is colonialism. The bad news is that colonialism keeps evolving, like influenza virus or HIV-1, or whack-a-mole. Just when you've smashed it, it pops up somewhere else in a new form. The good news is that its final stage of evolution may very well be democracy. Today we'll look at two countries in South America that are sick of having the rich North drain their vast resources, making the already rich much richer and the poor even poorer. First, I'll read from Greg Palast's book, Armed Madhouse. Greg shows how the Western financial institutions are bleeding Ecuador dry, or were, until Venezuela's Chavez helped them find a way to stanch the flow. Then, from his 2007 film, War on Democracy, John Pilger shows us around Bolivia, where a popular rebellion appears to have established real democracy. I wish we had some more of that ourselves. Here's my own small contribution to the discussion. We have a lot to learn from the South Americans on how to turn a de facto colony into a real democracy. And we'd better start learning fast because, look around. The country that's being colonized most rapidly today is named the United States of America. Ecuador is a great example of what's called neocolonialism. Ecuador flies its own flag, maintains its own army and navy, democratically elects its own president. But practically, Ecuador is as much a colony of the U.S. as the Virgin Islands are. We don't keep Ecuador in thrall with troops and tanks and bombs and helicopter gunships, like in Iraq. That way is, like, so 19th century. We keep it in thrall by wielding a silent, lethal weapon much more powerful than any conventional weapon. The legally binding contract. Here is part of Greg Palast's report. In Ecuador, parents who are too poor to have their children vaccinated have been hit with electric bills of $30 to $60 a month. This amounts to a price per kilowatt hour twice what United States consumers pay. Why, in a nation so painfully poor, is the World Bank, an agency founded after World War II to help the helpless, requiring this nation to sock it to electricity customers? Electrodollars, Mr. Beale! Electric utilities are marvelous cash cows. The costly systems are built with consumer and government funds, then privatized at pennies on the dollar. Electricity, water, and gas customers are hostages to the monopoly. The World Bank requires that consumers be charged for electricity based on a formula the World Bank supplied. The result? Consumers were required to pay rates that are far, far above the cost of producing the electricity. And that's not all. The World Bank also required Ecuador to raise prices on basic foods. What is behind such devastating cruelty, forcing Ecuadorians to choose between lights and food? Always ask, cui bono? Who benefits? Ecuador's bondholders in Miami, for sure. But first and foremost, the privatized electric companies. The huge difference between electricity cost and price is a windfall for the foreign owners, a windfall sucked right out of the Andes and sent straight to New York or to the Bahamas, or sometimes simply pumped up the hill to the huge homes commanding the best views of Quito. How that windfall is obtained is not always nice and rarely public. The World Bank, in its secret agreement with Ecuador, made sure the prices stayed sky-high. Electrodollars, Mr. Beale. One of the ways to squeeze dollar blood from the South American stone. That was Margaret Thatcher's formula. If you want to seize a nation's economy, grab it by its light bulbs. She used the terminology of military conquest, seize the commanding heights, to describe the sale of public utility systems. Privatize and deregulate public services, starting with electricity, telephone, and water systems. And the rest of the economy will soon be forced to adopt the free market nostrums of supply-side economics. The World Bank and IMF also required Ecuador to throw away its own currency and replace it with U.S. dollars. Those $60 electric bills, for example, must be paid by Quito residents in U.S. currency. As a result, Ecuador must borrow and pay interest on the U.S. dollar bills sitting in every Ecuadorian's wallet. When Ecuador's currency was dollarized, the wealthy took their crisp new bills and sent them literally to Miami. Ecuador's banks, with their dollar reserves missing and stashed in the United States, collapsed. The IMF demanded the nation's treasury bail out the bank's private shareholders. That added a huge new debt to be paid off by all Ecuadorians. There is anticipated future new wealth from a new oil pipeline beginning to be built. But the new oil wealth will be spent per World Bank orders as follows. 10% to social spending, 20% for contingencies, and 70% to debt buybacks, not for regularly scheduled budgeted amortizations. How generous! Ecuador gets to keep 10%. Social spending, by the way, means schools and medicine. The codicil says the big bucks, 70% of its new oil wealth, will go to bondholders to buy back their bonds. These payments are over and above the interest payments. Another 20% will go into an oil stabilization fund, that is, another reserve for bondholders. The bonds are held by speculators who, in most cases, purchase them for 20 cents on the dollar. These terms imposed by the IMF for new financing would make a loan shark blanch. But there's one more provision. Ecuador must agree to open its delicate jungle areas to oil drilling by Chevron Oil. This is the company that named a tanker after a corporate board member, Condoleezza. And there you have it. Ecuador, neocolonialism at its finest. And now on to John Pilger in Bolivia.
By the late 1980s, Washington's policy changed. Dictators like Pinochet were seen as an unnecessary embarrassment. A new and innovative way of controlling nations was launched. Like any new brand, it had a snappy name, democracy. It was largely fake, an illusion of marketing and spin. This brand of democracy meant that whoever you voted for, the policies would be broadly the same, and your country's economy would be in step with the United States. Washington would be your closest friend, or else. In the 1990s, these democracies in name replaced dictatorships in Latin America, with Chile providing the model. This is Bolivia, another laboratory experiment. The majority of the population of this spectacular, brutalized country, high in the Andes, have also been invisible until recently. The indigenous people, the Aymara and Quechua, carry memories of a culture and civilization and wealth long before the Spanish arrived 500 years ago. They remember how a single hill of silver underwrote the entire Spanish Empire while they became the poorest. This is the National Congress of Bolivia. Until recently, the faces here were almost all white, the descendants of a tiny Spanish elite which plundered the nation's riches and reduced the indigenous majority to serfdom. It was a pattern of control repeated all over Latin America. The pattern has been broken in Bolivia with the rise of social justice movements of a kind never seen before and whose democratic home is not Westminster or Washington or any other so-called model, but in the streets, the mines, the barrios, the fields. Governments that defy this popular power, this true democracy, do so at their own peril. This is El Alto, the highest city on Earth, and perhaps the poorest. The occupants of this cemetery on the roof of the world are mainly children, protected, they say, by the sacred mountain Illimanu. El Alto overlooks Bolivia's capital, La Paz. Juan Delfin, a priest and a taxi driver, has lived here for most of his life.
This is Villa Ingenio, the cemetery of northern El Alto. There is a sorrowful bitterness here. Our brothers, our children, our grandparents are dead and buried here. There was one family that poisoned themselves, the whole family, because of lack of work and lack of money. First, the husband poisoned his wife and children. Then he poisoned himself. We have seen cases like this.
When I first came to Bolivia in the 1960s, El Alto barely existed. The million people living here are peasants run off their land and miners made redundant by policies similar to those imposed in Chile. Infrastructure that didn't make a quick buck was privatized. The message was clear: sell it, strip it, or scrap it. The indigenous people were scrapped.
¿Por qué? Nos preguntamos.
Juan Delfín. We wonder, if I am a Bolivian, born rich, why am I begging? We had the sea, silver and gold. Why are we still suffering?
And yet the people here have held together. Their sense of identity, their community. In the year 2000, the people of Bolivia's second city, Cochabamba, fought an epic struggle to win back their most basic resource, water, from a foreign consortium dominated by the American corporation, Bechtel. And they won. Three years later, in 2003, Bolivia's power brokers were about to get another shock. This is Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada. Known as Goni, he was brought up in Washington. His English is better than his Spanish. They knew him here as El Gringo.
Isabel Atencio. I saw him as a fat man sitting on a golden chair, arrogant. Perhaps he was arrogant because of the power he had, which was his wealth.
When Goni was elected president of Bolivia in 2003, he backed a law that amounted to a fire sale of the country's resources. Almost everything was up for grabs, including Latin America's second biggest gas reserves.
Juan Delfín, we know we have gas, and it is being sold abroad to the almighty U.S. Yet still, I use wood for cooking. This is why the war started. We said, we will block, strike, and demonstrate until we get a response.
The people of El Alto fought back, blocking the roads leading into La Paz.
Isabel Atencio. There were calls to start blockades. Not even a fly would move. We stopped traffic and so on. But it gradually, what is the word? It gradually intensified.
Goni's response was the traditional Latin American way. He sent in the army to crush dissent. Scores were shot dead. Many were brought to Juan Delfín's church.
still, leaping so late and so early, till under their bite and their tread, the sweet and the wheat and the barley lay cankered and trampled and dead. A poacher's poor widow sat sighing on the side of the moss-patterned bank, where under the gloom of the fir woods, 1 acre of ground lay in rank. She watched over barely-grown clover, where rabbit or hare never ran, for the ground that it all covered over hid the blood of a good murdered man. She thought of a shaded plantation, and the hares and her husband's own blood, and the voice of her own indignation rose up to the throne of her God. There's blood on your new foreign shrub, squire. There's blood on your pointer's cold feet. There's blood on the game that you sell, squire. And there's blood on the game that you eat. You've sold out the laboring man, squire, both body and soul for to shame, to pay for your seat in the house, squire, and to pay for the feed of your game. You made him a poacher yourself, squire, when you'd give not the work nor the meat, and your barley-fed hares robbed the garden, had a starving poor little one's feet. When packed into one tiny chamber, man, mother, and little ones lay, while the rain pattered in on a bright bed, and the walls barely held out the day. Then we lay in the heat of the fever, on the mud and the clay of the floor, till you parted us all for 3 months, squire, and we knocked at the working house door. So to kettles and liveried varlets, where you starved your own daughter of bread, and worn out with liquor and harlots, see your heirs at your feet lying dead. When you follow them into your heaven, and your soul rots asleep in the grave, then, squire, you will not be forgiven by the free men you took as your slaves.
Scores were shot dead. Many were brought to Juan Delfin's church.
The tables were here. The bodies were
here.
They removed the bullets with nails even. It was sad to see this. The place was full. There were doctors everywhere. The smell of death was intense. All the orphans were crying and shouting.
Papa, papa, papa.
Tens of thousands of people poured down into La Paz, like the people of Venezuela's barrios demanding the return of their president, they demanded their country back. If the rich and powerful of Latin America had a nightmare, this was it.
Suddenly, we heard that Goni was about to resign. With one down, we felt inspired. It gave us strength. That was the aim, to make him resign.
Goni fled to the United States and is today living in a smart suburb of Washington. In October 2004, the Bolivian Congress ordered his arrest on charges of bloody massacre. George Bush has said, governments that harbor terrorists are as guilty as they are.
Pero toda esta oscuridad estamos así. El oscuro que nos ve. Toda la oscuridad.
This extraordinary mural was painted by Juan Delfin. It's a cry of freedom from an entire continent.
Todo mataron. Pero
they killed us all. But we defend the Aymara people with the Potuto horn, with our voice, with our fist, with the flag. We wave the huipala against the United States. This is the United States flag. We're against this because they have put us in the situation we are in. The fist is very important. That's how we are. That's us.
In 2005, the people of Bolivia took an historic step. For the first time ever, an indigenous person was voted president in a landslide. Like Chavez in Venezuela, Evo Morales offered a new democracy and a new beginning.
Bolivian President Evo Morales.
Que todos
we ask everyone to start working. The party is over. The honeymoon is over. And it is over forever. For a new Bolivia.
Sin duda que está creciendo.
Hugo Chavez.
Se está propagando.
There is no doubt that it is growing. It is propagating itself all over the whole continent of Latin America, of the Caribbean too, but mainly South America. I go around Latin America, from Buenos Aires to Brasilia, Montevideo to La Paz. There is a fervor sparking off everywhere. There is a fervor.
In Latin America, there's now a host of leaders offering new beginnings. Of course, history is crowded with heroes who offer new beginnings. The respectability of great power and its games and deals and plunder always beckon. If these new leaders succumb, their biggest threat may not be from Washington, but from the people on the hillsides.
I was born. In a little tent, oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too. Beyond the sky, it's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
Mariela Machado.
El futuro para mis hijos.
This isn't just Chavez's struggle, it's our struggle. What Chavez has unleashed is a recognition of this struggle. We are in it together, and we'll carry on fighting. So the empire's struggle isn't with Chavez, it's with us. Hugo Chavez. The Great Awakening has arrived. And I think Victor Hugo. Let's end with him. I'm with him on this. Victor Hugo wrote, "There is nothing so powerful as an idea whose time has come." The American Empire has reached its end, and the world must now be governed by the rule of law, of equality, of justice, a fraternity.
What happened here at the National Stadium in Santiago, Chile, has a special place in the struggle for freedom and democracy throughout Latin America and the world. The vow is never again. And yet it has happened again at Guantanamo Bay and all the other secret places where imperial power, regardless of its democratic pretensions, hides and tortures its perceived enemies. The questions raised in this film are urgent. Are the lives and dreams of the ordinary people of Chile, like the people of Venezuela, like the people of Bolivia, like the people of Nicaragua, like the people of Vietnam and Iraq and Iran and Palestine, expendable, worth only a few seconds on the news, if they're lucky? The answer is no. And those who see the world through the eyes of the powerful should be warned. People are rising from the tyranny and oblivion to which we in the West have consigned them. Indeed, their resistance is well underway, as this film has shown. I would say it never stopped and is unbeatable.
I go to the movie and I go downtown. Somebody keep telling me don't hang around. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
Been listening to a radio adaptation of the 2007 film War on Democracy, written and directed and reported by John Pilger.
And thank you, Lynn. Pilger's two-hour film was adapted to radio by Lynn Gurry of Unwelcome Guests Collective, www.unwelcomeguests.org. Thank you for listening. New World Notes is produced in the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of the University of Hartford. New World Notes is available to you in many ways, and there's even a free archive. For more information, check out our blog. We're at http://newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Your feedback is welcome. You'll find my email address at the blog, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. The opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily represent the views of anyone but me, John, and a few South American heroes of mine. From darkest New England, this is Kenneth Doust, wishing you a good week and advising, illegitimi non carborundum, keep the faith, and don't despair, you are not alone. Ciao!